Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen im Falterradio. Die Rückkehr des Gestern, The Return of Yesterday, ist der Titel dieser ungewöhnlichen Folge. Es ist die Antrittsvorlesung von Mischa Glenny in einem kleinen, aber mit großer Ausstrahlungskraft ausgestatteten Think Tank in Wien, dem Institut für die Wissenschaften vom Menschen. In dieser Folge hören Sie auch von einer weiteren internationalen akademischen Institution in Wien, der Central European University, die eine neue Rektorin, Charlene Randeria, feiert. Mischa Glenny, der neue Chef des Instituts für die Wissenschaften vom Menschen, ist ein britischer Historiker und Publizist, der mit einem spektakulären Buch über organisierte Kriminalität in gesellschaftlichen Umbruchssituationen Aufsehen erregt hat. Das Buch trägt den Titel Mac Mafia. Es ist eine globale Spurensuche in Russland, auf dem Balkan, in Brasilien und China, die zu Filmen, Videos und heftigen politischen Diskussionen geführt hat. Glennys Reportagen und historische Bücher zum Balkan sind Standard. In seiner Antrittsvorlesung in Wien zieht Mischa Glenny einen großen historischen Bogen der europäischen Geschichte von Martin Luther bis zu den Umwälzungen von heute. Die Rückkehr des Gestern, The Return of Yesterday.
When I came here, when I was preparing to take up the position of rector, I began to read and reread some of Austria's most influential authors born in the last year of empire, chiefly Schnitzler, Zweig and Roth. Stefan Zweig's intriguingly coy autobiography, Die Welt von Gestern, described the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century as a world which was discarding prejudice, which was discarding rigid hierarchies and stiff moral codes for ones which promised unprecedented freedom and progress. As Zweig himself admits, so dazzling was this period, especially if you lived in Vienna, that it obscured that the world was also pregnant with extreme violence. Following this, I read Zweig's biography of Erasmus, prompting me to reconsider another period of history that had always fascinated me, the 16th and 17th centuries. Western Europe began a long decade in 1517 that ended in about 1534. These 17 years were every bit as extraordinary, traumatic, and exciting as the long decade that we have been experiencing since 2008. Indeed, by the standards of the time, they were yet more momentous than everything we have experienced, however difficult that may be to grasp. It began with what on the surface might have appeared a rather small gesture, a man nailing a piece of paper onto a door. But this act set in train a series of events that would change the course of European history. The man was, of course, Martin Luther, and he nailed his 95 theses to the Schlosskirche in Wittenberg around the day, October the 31st, which is now recognized variously by Christians either as Reformation Day or the Day of the Dead. The long decades ends with the renunciation of papal authority and Roman Catholicism in 1534 by three North European countries, England, Denmark, and Sweden. Now, most contemporaries regarded them as second division, second tier in the great power hierarchy of the time, although doubtless Henry VIII's blind self-belief had already engendered tales of English exceptionalism. But whatever league those three countries were in, never before had recognized and broadly coherent states wedded themselves to heresy. Religious dissenters had, for the first time, access to the real structures of political power. And along with these northern states, there was another group of political dissenters, the princes, dukes, and counts, whose territories elected the Holy Roman Emperor, the secular guarantor of papal supremacy. We now call much of these lands Germany, but it was once the knottiest part of a dense tangle of polities. None of this really does justice to the story of the long decade. Those 17 years marked the beginning of the ascent of Europe at a moment when Christendom had never been closer to extinction. This was highlighted most dramatically by two events that took place in 1521 within just days of each other. One represented Europe's superiority in the exercise of raw power, the other its inferiority. On August the 13th, 1521, after 3 months of siege, Hernán Cortés captured Tenochtitlan and brought the Aztec Empire to a close. 6,500 miles away, along with an estimated 30,000 soldiers, was encamped in Zemun to the west of Belgrade, the most southerly fortress of the Hungarian kingdom, but peopled largely, of course, by Serbs, Suleiman's forces besieging the White City, as Belgrade was known, and he duly conquered it on August the 28th. Cortés's victory was a turning point in the extraction of mineral and vegetable resources from Central and South America, which would flood Spain, Portugal, and by extension other European countries with unprecedented wealth over the next two centuries. It was also the starting gun for a race between European nations to compete for global commodities that would last almost five centuries and would systematize genocide and plunder as never before. But that was all still to come. People had certainly fantasized about what the Americas held, but the gold, silver, Brazil wood, sugar, rubber, and everything else had not yet arrived in significant quantities by 1521. This future bonanza certainly hadn't entered Suleiman's the Magnificent's calculations. The Ottomans believed they were knocking at a European door made rotten by ill discipline and moral corruption, which, to be fair, is more or less what Luther was saying. After their success in Belgrade, the Ottoman forces were not minded to end their campaign. They followed a quick diversion south to mop up the strategic island bastion of Rhodes with a move on Mohács in 1526, where they crushed the forces of the sickening Kingdom of Hungary, leaving the path to Budapest wide open. If ever you drink beer with Hungarians, you will notice they refuse to clink glasses when saying Egészségedre, or cheers. They ascribe the defeat at Mohács to their Magyar warriors getting blind drunk the night before the battle, a credible scenario if my experiences as a student visiting Hungary are anything to go by. Ottoman perceptions of the decadence of their Western opponents were confirmed a year later. In 1527, the two great temporal and spiritual defenders of Christendom came to blows when the forces of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, sacked Rome and forced the Pope to flee. For the emerging doctrine of Lutheranism, I haven't yet got onto the bit where I talk about digital communications, so I don't know where that noise is coming. For the emerging doctrine of Lutheranism, this was powerful evidence of God's displeasure at the status quo. The Ottomans certainly believed that Christendom was close to its final demise. From Budapest, their terrifying army, accompanied by the ominous nasal half-tones of the woodwind zurna and the cursed drums, beat its relentless path towards Vienna, one of the two imperial seats of the Habsburg Emperor Charles. With the city all but surrounded, these events rather took the shine off the successes which Charles's other great territory, Spain, had been notching up in the previous 30 years, culminating in the final defeat of Moorish power in the controversially named Reconquista. Having ebbed in Granada, the tide of Islam was now making its way up the Danube towards Vienna. Aside from his disputes with France and its allies, a whole other story which I don't have time to go into here, Charles was facing huge turmoil in the very heart of the Holy Roman Empire, the German principalities and city-states. The conclusion which the Church and Charles drew from the Ottoman advance was that if Christendom were to survive, it needed to concentrate its energies on the threat from the East and project the same unity of purpose which made the Sultan look so threatening. In order to do that and to further his own domestic ambitions, Charles was convinced the heresy of Lutheranism must be eradicated. And why wouldn't he succeed? After all, heresies had emerged regularly over the previous 300 years, occasionally aspiring to and even briefly assuming the functions of state. That had certainly been the case with the great predecessor of Lutheranism, the Hussite Rebellion, and subsequent wars which stretched across two decades at the beginning of the 15th century. Jan Hus was burnt at the stake after being pronounced guilty of heresy at the Council of Constance in 1415. But far from cowing his huge following in his native Bohemia and neighbouring Moravia, it fired them to take up arms and mount a stupendous challenge to both papal authority and Habsburg power. The Hussite movement, which began as religious dissent, was pregnant with modernity and even nationalism. Jan Hus's support for the reform and use of vernacular Czech gave the movement a distinct national character. This was built upon by the great military leader who led the Bohemian forces after Hus's death, Jan Žižka, immortalized in the Prague district of Žižkov. But the revolt failed to spring the boundaries of Bohemia and Moravia. From Hus, the Pope, the Holy Roman Emperor, and their allies learned that the need to crush heresy was not just a doctrinal imperative, but a political one too. Suleiman's assault on Vienna a century later in 1529 helped Charles V conclude that Lutheranism needed to be nipped in the bud before it assumed a military capability, as Hus's teachings had done. This was not the last time the Ottoman Empire would place Vienna, the Habsburgs' eastern capital, under siege, but this was their best shot. Were it not for truly atrocious weather conditions, the Ottomans may well have conquered the city in 1529. More clement conditions, and Europe, not to mention its demographics, would probably look very different today. But as it turned out, this siege was the last serious challenge to Christendom coming from the East, right at the very moment when Europe appeared close to collapse, as Christians turned in on themselves in doctrinal mayhem. During the next 120 years, those internal religious divisions in Europe, which solidified once Protestantism succeeded in marrying the state in Northern Europe, resulted in an immense accretion of European power that would, in a broad sense, determine the course of global history over the next 500 years. So why did this happen in the long 1520s? Why did Lutheranism succeed where Hussite endeavours failed? Why did the outwardly stagnant economy of Europe start its transformation into the engine of global dominance? And why were the Turks never able to offer an existential threat to Europe again? A large part of the answer to all three questions lies in developments in technology that had taken place in 80 years prior to Luther's publication of his theses. Gutenberg and friends invented the printing press in 1440, just half a decade after the Hussite Wars had wound down. In the next 60 years, books went berserk. By the end of the 15th century, some 35,000 editions, amounting to 15 to 20 million copies at the very lowest estimate, were circulating around Europe. But these figures were dwarfed in the first 50 years of the 16th century. Until the printing press, the church was, of course, able to exert extensive control over the content and distribution of books, compellingly described in Umberto Eco's masterpiece, The Name of the Rose. By the time Luther's printing press friends were churning out translations of the Theses and his other works in German, a book could become a bestseller across Europe within 2 months. Erasmus had already sent a copy of the Theses and Luther's other writings to Thomas More some 3 months after the German had attached them to the church door. Germany and its mining community was also central to the second great technological breakthrough, the matchlock arquebus, first fired in anger in Europe in 1475, and before long being distributed around the towns and cities of the continent with the same happy abandon you might experience today in the United States at a National Rifle Association exhibition of rapid-fire weapons. Gunsmiths and printing presses were partly concentrated in central and southern Germany because of the rich iron ore deposits in the region. Indeed, before he became a monk, Luther was an inspector of mines. What Germany lacked was any coherent state structure to exploit that technology. And finally, the Portuguese and then the Spanish adapted the sail technology of their Mediterranean neighbours so that the caravel no longer had to hug the shore when on trading or exploration missions. They could now cross the Atlantic. Accelerated information exchange, portable firearms, and vast natural resources from the Americas set Europe on an extraordinary path to modernity in which the struggle between the old and the new, the Protestant and the Catholic, the North and the South, would alternately trigger remarkable cultural and economic progress and pre-apocalyptic bouts of violence. Among the many startling events which characterized the wars of religion during the 16th and 17th century, one occupies a special place, the defenestration of Prague in May 1618. The Czech estates rebelled when the Habsburgs rescinded their right, granted 9 years earlier, to choose their own religion. A century after Luther had nailed his theses to the door, and 2 centuries after the first defenestration of Prague, a key moment in the Hussite Rebellion, members of the Czech estates hurled the king's representatives out of a window in Prague Castle. Their fall was broken when they landed on a huge pile of shit, an appropriate metaphor for everything that was about to happen. The event detonated, of course, a series of conflicts which together came to be known as the 30 Years' War. By the time it had ended with the series of agreements collected as the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, the central locus of economic and political power had largely completed its migration from south to north, concentrated on the Netherlands and Sweden, with England moving quickly up on the rails. And the continent was now divided into 3 zones of Christian influence: Orthodox to the east, Catholic to the south, and Protestant to the north, with the north-south divide running through a still highly fractured and deeply traumatized Germany, which had lost an estimated 50% of its population to the cataclysm that Westphalia brought to an end. It may have been an episode which the rest of Europe was quick to forget, but to the continent's later regret, the Germans certainly did not. To be sure, religious divisions and conflict continued after the 30 Years' War, but Westphalia confirmed the triumph of the interests of absolutist and republican states over the concerns of religious hierarchy. The modern had finally triumphed over the late Middle Ages, but it had taken 130 years and cataclysmic violence to do it. This model of fundamental technological breakthroughs, followed by astonishing social and economic advances in parallel with unimaginable violence and destruction, was repeated from the second half of the 18th century until 1945. It is in this period that human longevity suddenly shoots upwards. In 1870, the mean life expectancy around the world was 32 years of age. Even in the region with the longest average lifespan, Europe, it was still under 40 years of age. These figures had been broadly consistent for several centuries. Just 100 years later, in 1970, the figure for Europe, the Americas, and Asia was over 70 years old. And even in the world's most challenged region, Africa, it was already over 50. On the downside, the scientific leaps begun in the late 18th century also ushered in the era of industrial practices in the perpetration of genocide. And in 1945, just two explosive devices had killed somewhere in the region of 200,000 souls in Japan. These are figures that the commanders in the 30 Years' War could only gawp at. And this points to a fundamental difference between the Great Rush of Modernity from 1492 to 1648 and the Second Great Rush from the 1760s to 1945. Scale. To introduce the idea of scale, let me return briefly to the late 14th century, the 15th century, I beg your pardon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The one place I barely mentioned in my brief survey of the long 1520s was perhaps the most important place of all, Italy, home of the Renaissance, from which so much of modernity arose. And I wish here to talk about a specific type of scale, human scale. The concept of human scale relates to the archetype of a life in full, the individual as a whole, that combines self-realization with a community of relationships. The idea of relationship and proportion has a fine pedigree in the march of civilization. According to the Gospel of St. John, in the beginning was the Word. Significantly, the Word, or Logos, also means ratio, a web of relationships of both quantity and quality. As the classic scholar H.D.F. Kitto observed, the Greeks, notably Plato and Aristotle, had a totally new conception of what human life was for and showed for the very first time what the human mind was for. Renaissance humanism revived this classical ideal of a life lived to its highest purpose and potential. The archetypal image of the Renaissance and of human scale is Da Vinci's rendition of Vitruvian Man. The full title of Da Vinci's famous Vitruvian Man is Scheme of the Proportions of the Human Body According to Vitruvius. The drawing addresses a conundrum posed by the Roman architect Vitruvius regarding how one might square a circle using the human body as the guideline. Like Vitruvius, Leonardo was fascinated by how closely humans fashioned their environment, both consciously and unconsciously, according to the dictates of human scale. The Renaissance, as it emerged out of scholastic humanism, shook the central ideological support of the Catholic Church to its foundations. Perhaps the most important philosophical model to which much of the Church clung was the great chain of being. Humans stood in the very middle of this immutable hierarchy between God and base minerals. But those three technological shifts in printing, sail technology, and weapons, which we mentioned earlier, left God's omnipotence looking much less certain. Humans now questioned whether that order was quite so stable, and whether indeed God had not furnished us with the tools needed to climb the hierarchy. This enabled thinkers to break free of the straitjacket of the church's monopoly on intellectual inquiry, especially where in parts of Italy, Germany, Scandinavia, and England, local politics allowed or even encouraged it. The Renaissance served as the foundation for the Age of Reason and what came to be known as Enlightenment values. Perhaps the most elegant elaboration of this humanist ideal is found in Kant's concept of individual autonomy and its moral corollary in the categorical imperative. Kant put a sophisticated modern gloss on the ancient golden rule of reciprocity and mutuality, of doing unto others as we would have done unto ourselves. The categorical imperative requires us to universalize rules of conduct and to treat others as ends and never only as means. To be clear, there never has been a golden age. There is no halcyon time of wholeness to which we can return as individuals or as a society. Yet the archetype of three-dimensional wholeness inspired by the Renaissance, and especially as conceived by Da Vinci, still calls out to us. Let me now address the recent past and the present within this context. 1989, the fall of communism, which I reported on as the BBC's Central Europe correspondent, was the greatest rupture in global politics since the end of the Second World War, every bit as significant as Luther's theses or the French Revolution. As regime after regime crumbled, and with it the Iron Curtain, few, if anyone, now doubted the superiority of the Western model to deliver prosperity and unparalleled technological advance. The West had understandably claimed a decisive ideological victory, embodied in the title of Francis Fukuyama's famous essay, The End of History. These monumental events, from the revolutions of 1989 to the dissolution of the Soviet Union in December 1991, appeared as the denouement to a drama of conflict which had its origins even as far back as Reformation Europe. The most recent manifestation of those conflicts, the ideological rivalry between capitalism and communism, was fast withering as 1989 promised a new epoch. Fukuyama's belief that liberal democracy could not be improved upon and represented the end of a, if not the, great Hegelian dialectical struggle seemed vindicated. Around the world, previously ironclad dictatorships on both sides of the Cold War divide were discarding their armor to reveal softer, more colorful clothing. If they didn't hold multi-party elections, although many of them did, reforming states adopted some of the central tenets of the Washington Consensus, an agreement hammered out between Western governments and financial institutions, which affirmed the belief in the spread of interoperable financial and trade markets known as globalization. This idea found favor among the Tigers, Korea, Vietnam, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and even Ireland. China, India, and Brazil were reimagining themselves as emerging markets, ready to embrace the outside world after decades of introversion, if not hibernation. These countries had long viewed Western markets with suspicion. The relaxation of barriers to external investment were the first signs of a profound shift in the way the world economy operated. So tempting was the prospect of integration that the ruling white minority in South Africa decided it was worth giving up their political privilege to join in. They even permitted a small minority of black South Africans to share in their economic privilege, cheap at the price. Those countries who declined to partake of the feast, like Cuba, North Korea, or Turkmenistan, were regarded as quaint anachronisms, so small as to be dispensable, although even they had a contribution to make as adventurous tourist destinations. Those who went against the grain, such as Yugoslavia, where a ferocious civil war broke out soon after the collapse of communism, were slow learners who would quickly adjust to the new possibilities of post-Enlightenment prosperity and stability. The ecstasy was intense. It was a time of great hope, and it was also very short-lived. True, at the time we all took part in the street parties in the country of my birth, Great Britain, a new touchy-feely world was born, symbolised by the People's Princess, by Cool Britannia, and more broadly, Clinton and Blair assumed the main roles in the live show How the West Had Won. From now on, the whole world could be friends together. Behind this facade, however, the financial capitalism which had fundamentally changed the post-Second World War compact when Thatcher and Reagan introduced it in the 1980s was roaring ahead. Anything went during the 1990s, which I called the decade of delusion. Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. condemned the crackdown on Tiananmen Square in 1989, but no sooner had Eastern Europe's communist regime started to crumble, the Americans, led by a crusading Goldman Sachs and encouraged by China, hit on the great idea to turn China into the manufacturing heartland of the US. It took less than two decades before the financial system crashed in 2008, triggering the worst economic trauma since Black Thursday, the Wall Street crash of 1929, whose impact acted as redoubtable pander to Hitler's rise and its attendant calamities. Prime Minister Gordon Brown, President Obama, and their colleagues in Europe and in Asia succeeded in applying some emergency sticking plasters onto the world economy. Yet, in less than 8 years after the crash, malign autocracies were incubating in several parts of the world, nourished by the distress and inequality that the folly of the banks had served to emphasize and then promote. As in the decade which preceded both the First and Second World Wars, the alarums of nationalists and conspiracy theories soaked in emotive appeals began to drown out more rational voices. A profoundly significant technological development preceded the drama of 1989, just like it had in 1517 and 1789. In March 1986, I reported from the 27th Soviet Party Congress for New Scientist magazine. Mikhail Gorbachev had already launched his new policies of perestroika and glasnost. At this extraordinary event, Gorbachev and his Prime Minister, Nikolai Ruzhkov, made it clear where the party most urgently needed to inject some perestroika and glasnost into science, in particular computer technology and robotics for industrial and military applications. By this time, there were some 10,000 computers in the Soviet Union. The US, by contrast, boasted 1.3 million mainframe and mini computers. Put simply, the Soviets could not maintain parity in technological capacity and innovation, something that the Chinese watched extremely closely at the time, adjusting their research, development, and deployment models accordingly. Especially when combined with a rigid regime of censorship, the status model was incapable of maintaining parity in an industry in which research was driven not only by the immediate requirements of the military, but equally by the voracious desire of consumers. As a consequence, the Soviet Union's lag in military and industrial capability was already visible and unbridgeable. Oil extraction in the Soviet Union was cripplingly expensive because it relied on obsolete equipment. Without Western technology, Siberian oil could no longer compete on price with the Middle East. Moscow started cutting back subsidized supplies to its Warsaw Pact allies, who had to pay for the shortfall at world prices, something that Poland and Hungary in particular could ill afford to do, drowning as they were in debt owed to Western banks and governments. The other heavily indebted country in the region was Yugoslavia. It is no coincidence that events in Poland and Hungary drove the revolutionary moment of 1989, and that Yugoslavia did not possess the requisite constitutional capacity to avoid war in 1991. The reason why these three countries had saddled themselves with this immense burden of debt is worth a book in itself. Too complex to explore here, I will just throw in a teaser that the origins lay in the Yom Kippur War and the consequent OPEC oil crisis of 1973. As if to underline just how serious Soviet technological backwardness was, a month after the 27th Party Congress, a safety test at a plant just south of the Pripyat marches triggered an uncontrolled nuclear reaction, and Chernobyl's Reactor 4 exploded. Soviet socialism was reaching the end as a system that could compete with the West. If mountains of external debt killed communism in Poland and Hungary, tech killed the Soviet Union. The rapid advance of computer technology since the 1980s not only hastened the end of the Soviet Empire, it has wrought changes unlike any other technological innovation in history, because it has insinuated itself into and often created total dependency on almost every aspect of human, social, and economic interaction. But during the 1990s, few people were willing or interested in questioning the dramatic embrace of the technology. That long decade of delusion came to an end in 2008. After the Wall Street crash of 1929, it took a full 14 months before Austria's Kreditanstalt became the first major casualty of the shenanigans on Wall Street. 14 months. In 2008, it was just 4 days before almost every major bank around the world was staring into the abyss of global financial meltdown and collapse. Technology was critical both to the intrinsic financial crisis and the speed with which it spread from New York across the world. The heart of the crash, credit default swaps and collateral mortgage obligations, the subprime securitization vehicles that had enabled banks to leverage debt way beyond their ability to repay it. These vehicles were managed by algorithms. No single financial institution had the least oversight into exactly how much debt they were carrying. They were also unable to tame the monster once unleashed, and money just started flowing automatically out of banks across the world without anyone even having to press a button. On this occasion, government intervention, often improvised, narrowly saved us from economic and social Armageddon. We were literally hours away from a breakdown of human society. So as we sought to use technology to emulate God, we suddenly found ourselves loitering outside the gates of hell. Disoriented and frightened, we were losing our relationship, above all, to proportion and human scale. A central challenge at the current juncture of the human journey is that many of the technologies rightly credited for our material progress are also based on disintegration and reduction of the individual, breaking us down into data sets of DNA, revealed preferences in digital search histories, biometrics, financial data, etc. The quest for utility, efficiency, and convenience at a global scale necessarily reduces us to data points. Trillion-dollar industries are committed to this proposition. The idea of the individual, literally a being that cannot or should not be divided, is one of integration and wholeness. Yet it is the subject of ferocious division and subdivision in the name of progress, the market, and security, the state. In a sense, modernity constantly puts our integrity in jeopardy. As individuals, we should not be divided, but we also need to be connected beyond ourselves. We need relationships to find meaning and to thrive. What ultimately changes people's lives are relationships. As sentient beings, we need associative relationships in families, as friends, as citizens, co-workers. We need the right scale to live as humans in full. Technology allows us to adapt and extend ourselves beyond the constraints of body and place. Communications technology stretches the realm of our senses globally. This elasticity has been central to progress. Yet the question remains, how far beyond the inherent limitations of being human can we meaningfully extend without losing touch with who we are? The answer is certainly not fixed and may vary across individuals and societies and time. However, it does not follow that there are no limits. But in the past 30 years, technological advances and changes to the way we live have taken place at a speed never before experienced in human history. Our world has never been more connected, and yet we face an epidemic of loneliness, alienation, and stress-related illnesses. Our cluttered, frenetic, upgraded lives feel increasingly out of control. Our machines are supposed to work for us, but often we appear to be working for our machines. Technological triumphs have created new challenges, pushing some fundamental things out of joint, particularly in the less tangible realms of culture, character and spirit. Finding our balance and keeping our sanity will become ever more difficult as our lives become bigger. Technological change is full of consequences, intended and unintended, expected and unexpected, good and bad, invidious and insidious, to which humans must adapt. Reflecting on the course of the 20th century, the Russian poet Pasternak wrote somewhat ominously of the consequences of consequences. This insight has never seemed more important and has propelled us to ask some fundamental questions about how we will adapt and our lifestyles, ourselves and our lifestyles, to the effects of our radically new setting, a world defined by promising and powerful technologies, nuclear, genomic and digital, that are capable of disaggregating, disintegrating and also reintegrating or remaking many aspects of the world as we know it. And just at this moment, we face four crises, which I call the four horsemen of the modern apocalypse, each capable of extinguishing our species, not to mention most others. Top of the list, of course, is climate crisis. Second are weapons of mass destruction. The third we are all well acquainted with now, pandemics. And the last one is precisely our overdependency on networked computer systems and artificial intelligence. Our deepest misfortune is that these threats coincide with a crisis in politics that has helped some of the most venal, incompetent, and malevolent characters to some of the most powerful positions in the world. Trump, Bolsonaro, Putin, and Xi are not the cause of our problems. They are a symptom which indicates just how deeply the problems run. Since 2008, we have seen the failure of the Arab Spring, the failed Western intervention in Libya, the Russian seizure of Crimea and occupation of Donbass, the migration crisis, Brexit, Trump's election, the pandemic, Russian aggression against Ukraine, and now subsequently or consequently barreling towards us with unstoppable speed, stagflation, recession, and a crisis in the world's food supplies. Some degree of collaboration between two polities in turmoil, the US and China, is a sine qua non if we are to return the four horsemen to their stables. Europe will play a critical role in this and must find the mechanisms that can reduce the impact of its countless internal squabbles. In this, I'm glad to say that Brexit serves at least one useful and sobering purpose. I remain convinced that all other things being equal, the United Kingdom, if it still exists, will at the very least rejoin the single market, and the chaos which Brexit has caused domestically has led many other European political movements to revise their commitment to leaving the EU. As important as the great powers are the custodians of the world's major rainforests, Brazil, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Indonesia, to name three. We are still processing the depth and rapidity of changes taking place before our very eyes. In the 1520s and the 1530s, Europe saw a proliferation of individuals and groups who were predicting the end of the world. They based those predictions on superstitions and misreadings of religious texts. The threats facing us, by contrast, are evidence-based. It took 120 years after 1517 and 1789 for a technology-driven changing of the imperial guard to reach peak violence. The nature of the technological shifts, which were an important underlying cause of the events of 1989, are, by their very nature, now accelerating history at unprecedented speed. If we are to meet the profound challenges we face, then we must make sure that we remain in control of technology and that technology does not assume control over us. This will be the core issue affecting governance over the next 20 years of democracies and autocracies alike. Thank you.
Wir hörten die Antrittsvorlesung des neuen Rektors Mischa Glänny im Institut für die Wissenschaften vom Menschen. Bei den Kolleginnen und Kollegen des Instituts bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Den Text des Vortrages können Sie auch auf der Webseite des Instituts selbst nachlesen. Auch eine zweite internationale akademische Institution feiert dieser Tage eine neue Führung, die Central European University, die Zentraleuropäische Universität. Die Central European University ist eine Errungenschaft der demokratischen Revolutionen in Osteuropa. Der Gründer ist George Soros, der amerikanische Philanthrop und Milliardär. Einen Gutteil seines Vermögens hat Soros in die Unterstützung der Zivilgesellschaften in den ehemaligen kommunistisch regierten Staaten gesteckt. Die Central European University war ein Herzstück der Strategie zur Unterstützung von Demokratie und Menschenrechten. Der autoritäre ungarische Regierungschef Orbán hat die Universität aus Budapest vertrieben. Nicht ohne antisemitische Untertöne, weil George Soros aus einer Familie ungarischer Juden kommt. Die neue Heimat für die Central European University ist Wien. Sie hören gleich die Antrittsrede 2022 der neuen Rektorin der CEU, Shalini Randeria. Shalini Randeria ist Wahlwienerin, wie sie sagt. Die Sozialwissenschaftlerin kommt aus einer prominenten indischen Familie mit engen Beziehungen zu Freiheitskämpfer Mahatma Gandhi. Die Lehrtätigkeit der multikulturellen Studentenschaft der Central European University läuft zurzeit in Wien Favoriten. Die Steinhofgründe an der Baumgartner Höhe, ein prestigeträchtiges und denkmalgeschütztes Areal, dürften als zukünftiger Standort aus Kostengründen aus dem Spiel sein, wie der Standard berichtet. Doch hören Sie die Antrittsrede von Shalini Randeria als neue Rektorin der Central European University.
Dear President Fischer, dear trustees, distinguished guests and colleagues, it's a pleasure to address you today as your president, finally, formally and officially. I cherish and acknowledge the trust that has been placed in me, and I'm immensely grateful and privileged to have all of you, CEU's trustees, well-wishers, near and afar, our faculty, staff, and students, and especially our founder, George Soros, who is watching the ceremony virtually as my partners in the adventure that lies ahead of us. This past year has been turbulent. It has not been that different from some of the previous years in having the odds stacked against us, though the odds have changed. The challenge of transition due to the forced displacement of our university was compounded by the pandemic that disrupted all academic routine. And just when a semblance of normalcy seemed to be returning, the Russian invasion of Ukraine upended the lives of many in our small community. We hold today's inauguration, originally planned for November last year, but postponed due to COVID, in the shadow of the devastation of this war. I opted for a scaled-down event to coincide with the CEU board meeting that allows many of our trustees to be present today. But the joy of the occasion, I must admit, is marred not only by the horrors of war and violence just a few hundred kilometers away, but equally by the fierce attack against girls' schooling in Afghanistan, the backlash against women's rights together with the systematic dismantling of liberal democracy and the rise of ethnic nationalism, intolerance, and a politics of resentment the world over. School textbooks are being banned and burnt as I speak. One of our students is imprisoned since 15 months in Cairo. Public universities are starved of funds and their independence is under attack. It is in this geopolitical context of the contest for soft power and an attack on open societies that CEU matters. CEU matters more than ever. And I'm acutely aware of the responsibility of leading the university in these troubled times. Our university is making its new home in Vienna, 31 years after its founding, in a dramatically reconfigured regional and global context, one that is inhospitable to the values we most cherish. And yet, these dark times make CEU's mission ever more urgent and relevant. We owe our establishment in 1991 as a trans-regional university to the bold vision and generosity of our founder, George Soros, who recognized not only the need to educate scholars, leaders, and civil society activists to further liberal democracies and open society values in this part of the world, but he realized the historic importance of free universities as institutions that could be and must be pivotal to processes of democratization. For universities ensure freedom of expression, as well as the development of creative thinking and critical inquiry. They provide space for debate and dissent. They nurture social engagement and service to community. The CU fought for these values. It stands for these values. Universities that are autonomous of state intervention and pressures of commercialization are a precious public good. They need protection, just as they are also themselves crucial for the cultivation of that public good. It would be an understatement to say that this year has been full of ups and downs for me in my very first year as your president and rector. I did not come 11 months ago to see you as a stranger. In fact, its very first rector and president, Bill Newton Smith, was my tutor at Oxford. I was a member of the university's board of trustees for the past 6 years, and more importantly, I had also been a faculty member 21 years ago in Budapest. I was appointed to establish the new Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology, in fact, bring it from Warsaw to Budapest then. I was appointed, as Helga Nowotny mentioned, by the then rector president, Yehuda Elkanah, a visionary institution builder and a mentor to me, who conducted the lives of all those around him with enlightened despotism and a tremendous sense of humor, which was unique to him. The art of improvisation I had learned in India stood me in good stead as I came to Budapest, for the new department I was tasked to build had no budget at all. Not only the department did not have an administrator, but my office in Srinivasa, which overlooked the magnificent basilica, had no furniture either. To cut a long story short, I spent my first year hiring the department's first 7 professors, designing the curriculum, recruiting the first cohort of students from across Central and Eastern Europe. To get a sense of the social and intellectual background of the students, I asked for support from the Open Society Foundation's Higher Education Support Program. It was the twin program set up simultaneously with the university to provide organizational and curricular support and to give back to those universities in the region from where our students and faculty were drawn. With HESP funding, I gave during 2001 and 2002 talks at almost every department of sociology that I could contact, from Prague to St. Petersburg and from Bishkek to Bucharest, which allowed me to meet faculty, discuss curricula, look at the library collections of those departments, and meet with students. But there were no funds to build up the CU's library for the department. So I built it up by requesting professors in the US who were retiring that year and thus needed to clear up their offices to donate their personal libraries to CEU. Many of them even shipped people unknown to me completely, who just received a letter from me asking for this donation. Many of them even shipped to Budapest books and complete sets of journals at their own expense. Then, as now, it was a deep dive into CEU that enabled a steep learning curve for me. Then as now, it was a year of experimentation and also occasional exasperation. If I was warmly welcomed as a new faculty member 21 years ago, I have received overwhelming support from members of faculty and staff, as well as our trustees and well-wishers in Vienna and around the world this past year. I'm immensely grateful for their trust, their advice, their encouragement. It's been a pleasure to work together with the new senior leadership team that I was fortunate to be able to assemble. And for me, it's been a homecoming, in a sense, to CEU after an absence of 2 decades, but to a university uprooted from its home. One of my priorities would be to give the university a new home in the city, a city that has been home to me since 8 years, to drive forward our excellence in research and to build on our interdisciplinary academic strengths. My experience of institution building that Helga Novotny mentioned in Zurich, in Geneva, also at the IWM here, should stand me in good stead. And unfortunately, I should say, many years, 30 years of ethnographic research on dispossession and on forced displacement in India, which has taught me the value of cross-cutting ties that bind communities, both scholarly and rural or urban, that I have been working with, unfortunately, that experience may also come to bear fruition. As the first innings, or the first year of my second innings, I should say, at CU draws to a close, and I apologize for this cricketing metaphor, but as a post-colonial subject, I may be forgiven for this reference. Now that the Indian cricket team has finally defeated the British one, I can safely summarize at least three lessons learned. One, that unlike what some of you, especially the students here, may imagine, the powers of a university president and rector are very limited, to say the least. And even a young and radical institution like the CEU is highly conservative and inclined to inertia when it comes to internal transformation. And our open society habitus, when practiced within the university, can mire us in endless discussions and consultations and slow down change. Secondly, that the university is not an autonomous institution, but highly dependent on its external environment. A tiny virus can throw it completely out of gear. But I also learned a third lesson, and probably the most valuable one, that a small and highly engaged university like ours can be nimble and innovative in meeting external challenges. Our students rose to the occasion and in an extraordinary display of solidarity, mobilized to collect medicines, clothes, food to send to families and organizations in Ukraine using all means possible. Some 30 of our faculty established the Invisible University for Ukraine within weeks of the Russian invasion. It offers virtual courses designed and taught jointly with Ukrainian colleagues, 225 students, all over Ukraine, who attend classes from wherever they are, from basements, from bunkers in cities being bombarded. I would like to commend and congratulate our students and faculty for these initiatives. Our university has built its reputation on its research excellence and its struggle for academic freedom, but the CEU is so much more also about than just imparting knowledge and fostering a strong spirit of intellectual curiosity, rigorous thinking, and critical inquiry. We pride ourselves on the diversity and inclusiveness of our community, and with good reason. Our student body from over 100 countries certainly makes it unique. We are a private university, but not an elitist one. More than 80% of our students receive financial support, quite unusually for a research-intensive and a research-driven university. And that should rightly make us proud. Our mission is to provide excellent research-based undergraduate and graduate education, which is affordable, irrespective of means or background. For the purpose of a university is to educate the next generation, to equip it with the knowledge it'll need to meet global challenges, trespassing all disciplinary boundaries, and to ensure that young scholars who leave the university are also engaged citizens, willing and able to contribute to make our world a more just, a humane and compassionate place. If our strong commitment to excellence of research and teaching, along with inclusiveness, makes us stand apart as an institution of higher education, the diversity of perspectives and experiences in every classroom at CEU creates a unique atmosphere for learning. We are a heterogeneous community, as you've heard from the president of our student union, with its own distinctive culture, polyphonic and argumentative, like democracy itself, in the best possible sense. CEU is also an ethos, a commitment to the values of open, just, and hospitable societies. But CU has always aspired and shall continue to aspire to become what Rakta Rida once called the university without condition. And I quote him, the ultimate place of critical resistance to all the powers of dogmatic and unjust appropriation, end of quote. It is an honor and a privilege to lead the university at this critical time and this crucial juncture, as it makes Vienna its new home, where I've had the pleasure to welcome it in my role as what one in German may say, a Wahlwienerin, a Viennese by choice, who has fortunately made this cosmopolitan city of arts and cultures my home, a city that hosts more universities than students than any other in Europe. In fact, for some of our guests who are not Wahlwiener, I may want to remind you that a majority of the universities in this city are currently led by women rectors. So I am by no means unusual as I stand before you here. It took us, and that's my last anecdote, it took us 30 years to get here, because when our founder, George Soros, thought of establishing the university, one of the cities which he looked at very carefully was Vienna. The reason Vienna did not work out then was that Austria did not have a law allowing private universities. So it's fortunately taken Austria a few decades to enact the law that has made it possible for us to move here. And we are grateful for that and for the very warm welcome that we have received. Our university was born of an audacious idea to transform societies through the power of education. We have taken many risks to carry forward this mission and to shape our own institutional future and that of our students with boldness of ambition. Resilience is the theme that runs through our three decades of existence. We are presented with an unparalleled opportunity here to meet the moment and to realize our mission, one that has become global today. It is upon us to seize this moment together. Thank you.
Die neue Rektorin der Central European University, Charlene Randeria, hat ihre Inauguration Speech, die Antrittsrede, am 24. Juni 2022 gehalten. Wir bedanken uns sehr herzlich bei der CU für das Okay und die Mithilfe bei dieser Übertragung. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. News aus der multikulturellen Welt von Akademia in Wien bekommen Sie im Falter. Daher meine Empfehlung, überlegen Sie doch ein Abonnement des Falter. Alle Informationen dazu gibt es über die Internetseite abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich und Miriam Hübel betreuen die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich, bis zur nächsten Folge.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.